everyone, and welcome to Medium Cool, a movie podcast. I'm your host, Austin Glidden, and as always, you can find us on social media by searching Medium Cool Pod on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, or X as the nerds call it. This first episode, using the new format, I'm going to address some housekeeping topics, actually. This is something I want to start doing up top if there's anything I need to cover. And so first, I just want to go back to the social media thing. Please check out our social media, Medium Cool Pod on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also email us at Gmail or at mediumcoolpod@gmail.com. Please check out our social media. Interact with me. If there is a movie or filmmaker or movement you want me to cover, please let me know. I'd love to look into things, different films and stuff that the listeners are interested in. So you can always interact with me. I'm happy to talk about film or anything that you want that's nerdy, you know, video games, D&D, pro wrestling, whatever you want, you name it, but especially film. Really, really love hearing what people are watching and how they feel about it. So please hit us up on social media. But in addition to that, my second little housekeeping point here, please let me know what you think of the new format and what you think I'm doing right or wrong or in between. You know, consider subscribing to the podcast wherever you're listening if you want. It really does help out. But if you subscribe, you can keep up. And you know, I don't know with the new format, because I am going more in depth. I may have to skip a week here or there just to make sure I can keep the quality up. And in doing that, by subscribing, you'll be able to see when we post episodes. My goal is to try to keep this more consistent, but there will inevitably be times where I have to, you know, take a little extra time to make sure that the episodes are good. So definitely subscribe. And again, definitely let me know what you like, what you don't. That sincerely could, it's not guaranteed, but it could sway how I approach certain topics. So I really do appreciate your, you know, listening to the episodes and your feedback. The third housekeeping thing, instead of using traditional ratings like I have in the past, 2.5 out of 5, 4 out of 5, 5 out of 5, whatever, I've established a 5-tier system here. And my thought in this is I think of them as 5 boxes, okay? And so the 5th box is just the worst among them. And, you know, that's where you toss all the shit you never want to see again. And then tier 1 is the God tier, right? So tier 5 is called bottom of the barrel. That's what tier 5 is. This is the absolute worst of the worst. The only kind of placeholder movie I have on here, which I haven't talked, well, I've actually ranted about this movie a lot on the show, but we haven't addressed it, you know, thoroughly, is Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey. What a fucking horrible movie. I actually want to do an episode on it in spite of it. That's what I want to do. Talk about the whole background and how they got to use Winnie the Pooh and all that crap, and then just shit all over this pile of, well, shit. So yeah, bottom of the barrel, the worst. Okay. So this would be like 1 star and below movies that you're going to get on there. If you want to kind of draw some parallel to the rating system. So then tier 4 would be anything from about 1.5 to 2.5 stars. If you, again, just giving you kind of an idea of what this means. And forgettable flicks is the 4th tier. And this is movies that I largely don't recommend. This would be movies like personally, True Lies for me is like a 2-star experience. at the complete dismay of Sam Watermeyer, who loves this movie. I'm not a fan. So that would be a forgettable flick that just don't even pay attention to this movie. Now, could we argue that there are a lot of things that could bump that up in tiers? Yes. But in full transparency, that's kind of just a placeholder. I basically went through a lot of the episode titles and started populating some of these lists a little bit based on things that we've talked about on the show. And although we haven't covered True Lies in depth, it was the movie I mentioned a lot. And quite frankly, we haven't covered a ton of movies that I truly, truly despise or even really dislike to some major degree. And I mostly kept off a lot of the new titles that we did on the show. I was a lot of those, I think, deserve a rewatch for me because most of them I saw during the cram season of a year. You know, so I try to be really fair. But a lot of these that are on here are just older movies, unless they are new enough and I remember them and have seen them multiple times and feel confident. So forgettable flicks is tier four. Again, these aren't the worst of the worst, but they can vary from pretty bad to meh, you know, that kind of thing. Ultimately, I'm not a big fan, not really high on them. Now, tier three is a pretty large box, all right? This has a pretty wide breadth of quality. In this one, we're looking at somewhere around that 2.5 to 3 stars to about 4, okay? So this is a high 2.5, we'll say, to 4, and a low 4, so to speak, you know. But in this, we have a lot of movies. A movie like Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia, which we covered on the show. I'm not a huge fan of that, but you should check it out. It's not bad. One of our listeners tell me to watch The Beast of War, which I watched during our Hidden Gems marathon or whatever it was that I did. Really cool movie. Definitely check it out. I'm pretty sure that I gave this, 4 stars, but it's a low 4. I'll be honest. It's a low 4. Okay. There are a lot of movies on here, and a lot of them you'll probably look and you'll be like, why the fuck is this here? You know, why isn't this higher? For example, Todd Haynes' Safe. I like this movie. I gave it a 4-star rating, right? But it's just a watchable wonder, which is what tier three is. Watchable wonders. These are anywhere from just, you know, positively watchable to this is a pretty good movie, you know. That kind of a response is what you will get with tier three. Now, tier two is where a lot of movies are going to go as well. This box is equal to, if not even a little bigger probably, than watchable wonders. This is tier two Hall of Excellence. All right. So the Hall of Excellence is everything below God tier. This is a high 4-star all the way to some 5 stars. For example, 310 to Yuma, the original 1957 film, is a 5-star experience to me, but I don't think it's that kind of transcendent experience or that that unique, just truly mind-blowing experience. It's just a really fucking good Western. It's one of my favorites of all time. So that one's great. We also have movies like, you know, Dick Johnson is Dead, which was a phenomenal documentary to me that came out back in, when was that, 2020? I think during the pandemic. And what a phenomenal documentary. It didn't like change my life. It was just fucking great. But it belongs in the Hall of Excellence, an absolute excellent movie. Everything Everywhere All at Once. I've seen that movie like 5 times now. Every time it makes me cry. It's so good. But it belongs in the Hall of Excellence to me, okay? So there's tier two. And then finally, tier one. This is just simply titled the Medium Cool Pantheon. This is the God tier. This is the Transcendent Experiences. This is 2001 A Space Odyssey. And then there's even movies like Annie Hall, which is, to me, the archetypal, like the perfect exemplar of an kind of an anti-romantic comedy of sorts, or whatever you want to call it. It is The Apartment is an exemplar of a perfect romantic comedy. Faces is an exemplar of performance, of improv, of making you of humanity, right? So I think The Shining is one of, if not the greatest horror movie ever made. Pulp Fiction, obviously, and so on. The Godfather, things like that. Some of them, those movies are just kind of transcendent. They're just either just too important, or I appreciate them too much, and they're just fucking phenomenal. In my opinion, that they have just made the God tier. There are only currently 14 movies in the God tier in this Medium Cool Pantheon, but we will add them as we go. So I just wanted to give you an idea of what that is, tier 1 through 5. Again, that's tier 1 is the Medium Cool Pantheon. Tier 2 is Hall of Excellence. Tier 3 is Watchable Wonders. Tier 4 is Forgettable Flicks. And tier 5 is Bottom of the Barrel. And these lists will be housed on the Medium Cool Podcast page on Letterboxd. I do have that up. I have not been using it because I ended up just encouraging people to go to my page. But I will admit that that page will mostly be dedicated to housing and archiving different lists. And I'm going to do my best to keep that up. So definitely go check that out. Like us on there as well. All of this should be in the show description with links and everything. And then finally, I want to talk a little bit about a few recent deaths in the cinematic world here. You know, the first this is the first episode since Gina Rowlands died on August 14th, a completely sad day, you know, for one of many reasons, but because, you know, she was an absolute legend. And I mean, just watch A Woman Under the Influence from 1974 and tell me she's anything less than brilliant. So rest in peace, Gina. You will live through the art you created. And also Alain Delon, Le Samurai himself, died on August 18th, 4 days apart. What a horrible week that was for cinema lovers. But he was an unforgettable talent as well. Double feature. I don't know. Matthew Soucy may think this is a bummer and just be like, don't make people do that. But A Woman Under the Influence from 1974, Le Samurai, which I don't have the year in front of me, but I believe it's from the mid 60s. That's all I can tell you right now. 65, 66, something like that. But in memory of them, go watch a movie with Alain Delon or Gina Rowlands in it. Hell, if you want, even watch The Notebook. Gina Rowlands is in that. I'll take it just for her sake. But anyways, all that said, let's move on to some information about this episode. Now, today we're going to be dedicating this episode to Paul Schrader, who just turned 78 last month. And prior to doing this new format, I knew I wanted to do something on Paul Schrader because the Criterion Channel still had the Paul Schrader Films collection up on the site. And, you know, we're just taking advantage of it. So for this episode, I'm going to take a more biographical approach to Schrader, discussing the contexts, you know, that help us, the viewers, see his process and style, you know, a bit more clearly. And so, you know, we'll do another episode or two that focuses on his films. The four that I've picked to really focus on a bit deeper is Hardcore, Cat People, Mishima, A Life in Four Chapters, and Light Sleeper, all of which Matthew Soucy will be joining me to discuss, and that will be a good time. Now, I will say, because I don't know what I'm going to do for this episode, so as you listen, it's going to be a surprise. I might cut some of Matthew Soucy's stuff into this one as well, but I do want to say that something went weird with my recording software, and it recorded Matthew Soucy and my voice on the same track, and his voice was a billion times louder than mine because I do try to keep mine lower and then I can adjust it in post. And so I had to basically separate all of our voices out into two tracks. So if it sounds pretty good still, don't get me wrong, but I mean, if we're going back and forth a lot, you'll definitely hear that. Please bear with me on that. I freaking hate that the first episode back has a weird wonky thing like that, but whatever, live with it, you know, just, this is a hobby, shut up. So, prior to the last 2 weeks, a lot of Schrader's films were complete blind spots to me, including movies like American Gigolo and Affliction. Several of his films that he wrote and did not direct, like The Yakuza and Rolling Thunder. I mean, I hadn't even seen Cat People, Mishima, A Life in Four Chapters, or Light Sleeper, and I'd only seen Hardcore once years ago. I had seen Autofocus years ago, to the point that when I rewatched it to do this whole piece, because I tried to watch as many of his movies as I could, and watching Autofocus, it was like watching it for the first time. There were certain scenes I kind of remembered, but I mean, some of the bigger scenes that I didn't remember how it ended. I didn't remember, I'll just say it this way for now, I didn't remember Willem Dafoe in The Watch, which that is something I would definitely remember. I may have fallen asleep during it when I originally watched it. I don't know, but that movie's great. So I was able to watch a lot and get caught up on a lot of Schrader's work. And I just encourage you, if you're watching Schrader movies or you plan to, or maybe you've already watched them in the past and have a pretty decent memory of them, I would love to hear your thoughts on them. Heck, if you want, I may even read them on the show. But for now, let's go explore the life and mind of Paul Schrader. So we're going to go ahead and start with some history here, and we're going to start with Paul Schrader's early life. Born on July 22nd, 1946 in Grand Rapids, Michigan, Paul Schrader grew up in a devoutly religious family of Dutch Calvinists. His upbringing was defined by the rigid doctrines of the Christian Reformed Church, known for its strict moral code and conservative values. Schrader's father, Charles A. Schrader, was an executive in the furniture industry, while his mother, Joan Fisher Schrader, was a homemaker. The family environment was one where religious devotion was central to daily life. And a significant aspect of Schrader's early life was the strict prohibition against many forms of popular culture, including movies. Cinema was considered sinful and worldly in the Schrader household, and it was a belief that was really rooted in the Calvinist idea of total depravity, which I won't go into now, but it does emphasize the inherent sinfulness of human nature. And as a result, Schrader did not see his first movie, get this, until he was 17 years old. It is a fact often cited as as crucial in the development of his later cinematic style. So despite this sheltered upbringing, Schrader was an intellectually curious child, and he was a voracious reader, and his early exposure to literature, particularly religious and philosophical texts, laid the foundation for his later interest in exploring complex themes such as guilt, redemption, and moral ambiguity, things like that in his films. And so Schrader's early education was also shaped by his religious background, as he attended Calvin College, a Christian liberal arts college in Grand Rapids. It's where he studied theology and philosophy. And Schrader's life took a pivotal turn during his time at Calvin College. It was here that he began to rebel against his strict and sheltered upbringing. And although he remained deeply entrenched in the Calvinist worldview, he started questioning the rigid moral and cultural boundaries that had defined his life. And so this period of questioning and exploration led him to take an interest in the arts, particularly in literature and film theory. So it was during this time that Schrader first encountered the work of filmmakers like Robert Bresson, Carl Theodor Dreyer, and Yasuhiro Ozu, directors who would later become major influences on his work. And so his introduction to cinema came through a college professor who encouraged him to watch movies as a way of broadening his understanding of the world, something I encourage each and every one of you to do, by the way. I think although movies can obviously be really ridiculous and hyperbolic or just quite frankly unrealistic or mistreating the facts of history or whatever the case, I think if we can engage with film, we can learn a lot about ourselves. And that is one place, as someone who grew up in a very sheltered household, film really taught me a lot and still to this day does, but I digress. So although Schrader's first viewing was The Absent-Minded Professor from 1961, which may not have been particularly profound, it marked the beginning of a lifelong obsession with cinema. So Schrader's exposure to film expanded further, when he moved to Los Angeles to attend UCLA, where he studied film theory and criticism under the guidance of film scholar and critic Pauline Kael. If you don't know who Pauline Kael is, just go Google the name Pauline Kael, an absolutely pivotal member of the film criticism community, especially for that time. But I'll get there. So for those who don't know, Pauline Kael is one of the most renowned film critics of her time, most prominently during her time at The New Yorker from 1968 to 1991. And Kael encouraged Schrader to pursue a career in writing about film, which led to his first major work, Transcendental Style in Film, Ozu, Bresson, and Dreyer from 1972. And this book, which explored the spiritual and ascetic qualities of the films of these directors, established Schrader as a serious film scholar and laid the groundwork for his later career as a screenwriter and director. let's take a moment and talk about transcendental style first, because I think this is really, you know, monumentally important for Schrader's development as a film presence, so to speak. And it's really cool to think about, I think. So it is essentially about withholding the cinematic device. So what is a cinematic device? When Schrader talks about the cinematic device, he's referring to the techniques and tools filmmakers use to create a specific effect or response in the audience, okay? So this could be anything from the way a scene is shot, the use of music or the pacing of the editing, all the elements that work together to make a film engaging, emotional, and suspenseful. For example, if a film wants to make you feel, you know, tense or scary, they may use quick cuts or eerie music or dark lighting. These are all parts of the cinematic device, the methods used to manipulate the viewer's emotions and guide their experience of the film. But what Schrader is talking about with transcendental style is trying to employ a style of filmmaking that aims to evoke a deeper, often spiritual response from the audience by being more restrained. So instead of using obvious techniques to provoke or manipulate an immediate emotional reaction, the filmmaker holds back, using minimalism and subtlety to allow the viewer to engage with the film on a more contemplative level. So in layman terms, the cinematic device, as we talked about, is the filmmaker's toolbox full of tricks to make you feel a certain way when you watch the movie. And what Schrader is interested in is the power of not using these tricks so overtly, letting the story and images speak more quietly, which can create deeper and more profound experiences. Now, this could be holding shots longer than expected, maybe you don't cut when the audience might anticipate it. This creates what can be described as dead time, moments when nothing is happening. The viewer is left to watch this absence of action. So filmmakers like Apichatpong, where Seth Akul, Yasuhiro Ozu, or Andrei Tarkovsky, for example, are but a few notable examples of directors that come to mind with people that would use this framework, right? And so in real life, people don't usually focus on dead time. But in cinema, it's different. For instance, in Vittorio De Sica's 1952 film Umberto D, there's a famous shot of a maid striking a match three times. And it's no longer about the act of striking the match. It's about how long you're willing to kind of sit and watch this. It's challenging in a certain way. Now, I'll talk about that a bit more. Stick with me here. So it's about what is happening internally during this time. It's forcing us to go below the surface. It's adding, literally, depth there. So the filmmaker uses the power of cinema itself kind of against itself to pull you into a state where you must participate actively. And as an active participant, further building your investment. And that is the crux of this concept of transcendental cinema, or style, rather. So most films aggressively grab your attention, demanding every second of it. And it can be great fun. I mean, my wife and I have seen a bunch of horror movies recently in the theaters over the past few months that have been coming out. Things like Cuckoo or Strange Darling, or, you know, movies like that, Alien Romulus. And these are great fun, but these are almost exclusively interested in the audience's entertainment, and the films are treated as such. Take Marvel movies, for example. There's nothing wrong with this approach, right? But there is a place in cinema for it. I don't want to be mistaken. But Schrader is interested in these types of transcendental films versus movies that are simply there to purely manipulate you into having a good time, going back to the Marvel movies thing. And even if you want to go back further in time, we can talk about, not further per se, but back a few years whenever Scorsese mistakenly, because of, you know, the film community, but when Scorsese said that Marvel movies weren't cinema or whatever he said, right? This is actually more along the lines of what he's talking about. It's less about it being a derogatory term and more saying, hey, no. These are just like mass popcorn flicks that are essentially made for your entertainment and quite frankly are shallow and really just lack all depth. So if you don't like what it's offering, it's not going to be great. It doesn't challenge you in any way. It doesn't really do anything for you other than give you a superficial entertainment experience. I'm probably going to get hell for that. But the point is, you know, Schrader's interested in transcendental films. And going back to Schrader here, he loves them precisely because they lean away from you. They use time and what others might call boredom, you know, as a technique. If you're skilled enough in using these techniques, you achieve something rare. You activate the viewer. So once the viewer begins to engage on their own, it becomes much more powerful. And when you use quote unquote boredom, and I'm using literal air quotes right now when I say that, but when you use boredom as an aesthetic device, the challenge is knowing when it's effective and when it's simply just boring. And if you constantly withhold drawing the viewer in, you know, there comes a moment when you have to introduce an element of freedom, something unexpected. In a Bresson film, it could be a sudden burst of music. Imagine watching a movie for 2 hours with no music at all, and then at the end, there's an explosive blast of Mozart, right? This is going to draw your attention, of course. The audience is conditioned not to expect it, so when it happens, it either shocks them or elevates their experience, or both. Both can be true. So let me give you another example. Imagine you're preparing a stew for dinner, okay? And it needs to simmer for hours. And at first, it seems like nothing's happening, just a pot of ingredients sitting there on the stove getting hot, okay? But as time passes, the flavors slowly blend together. The aroma fills the kitchen. You don't rush it because you know the longer it cooks, the richer and more complex the stew will become. And in transcendental filmmaking, the director holds shots for longer than usual and doesn't rush to cut or move to the next scene. This creates the kind of dead time, like I mentioned before, where not much seems to be happening on the surface, but beneath, the viewer starts to absorb the atmosphere and build their own emotional connection. And it's like letting the stew simmer, allowing time to work its magic. And by the end, when something unexpected finally happens, it hits with more impact because you've been patiently waiting and simmering in the story's world. And so just like that stew, the experience becomes richer and more satisfying because you've allowed it to develop slowly and naturally. So let's go even further here. Paul Schrader's characters can even be described in the same light that we've been discussing here, like George C. Scott's character in Hardcore, which we'll cover in the future here. They are central to his approach to transcendental filmmaking. These characters often draw viewers into their lives slowly, creating a deep sense of empathy over time. For example, in Hardcore, you begin to connect with Scott's character, you know, as you listen to his voice and observe his actions, such as, you know, when he expresses gratitude to a higher power for reuniting his family, etc. And this empathic connection is a natural response. You know, when we watch a character over time, we can't help but start to care about their journey, or so one would hope, right? Like in theory, that works. Of course, there are exceptions. There may be many exceptions, but in theory, the more time you spend with someone, as long as you don't fucking hate them, you'll probably start to care about their journey to some extent. Maybe I'm projecting. However, Schrader doesn't make this connection easy or straightforward. Just as you're fully invested in the character, he begins to behave strangely, challenging your initial feelings of empathy. So you start to question whether this person is truly worthy of your concern, especially as they seem poised to make decisions or take actions that you may not approve of. Yet by this point, you're so invested in their story, it's been over an hour at this point, you know, that you can't turn away. You need to see how it ends. And this tension between empathy and disapproval creates what Schrader might describe as a crevice in the viewer's mind. So on one side is the part of the movie you align with, and on the other is the part that, you know, makes you uncomfortable or challenges your values, that provides maybe a cognitive dissonance in some cases. And this crevice doesn't just disappear. It actually gets stitched up like scar tissue, to use Schrader's language, as viewers reconcile these conflicting feelings on their own terms. Again, engaging the audience. Now you're becoming an active participant with the story because it's giving you all the tools. It's giving you all the things to think about. Now the viewer is dealing with these things internally. And so making a film that is closer to a stew, so to speak, to call back to the earlier analogy, allows room for people to consider these things and accept the experience. And it is this process that is the hallmark of transcendental filmmaking. And Schrader's characters aren't just passive figures in a narrative. They are the catalyst for internal conflict and reflection in the audience. So the tension they create isn't meant to be easily resolved. It's meant to linger, to provoke thought, and to resonate long after the film ends. The quote-unquote beast in Schrader's stories, the primal intense force, represents this unresolved tension. So you can sense it through the film, groaning and struggling, waiting to emerge. And when it finally does, it forces you to confront the deeper, often uncomfortable truths that Schrader's work brings to light. But Schrader ties all of this into religion, which is kind of the direction I want to go into because it's really important to Schrader's journey. He said, and I quote, "Transcendental expression in religion and art attempts to bring man as close to the ineffable, invisible, and unknowable as words, images, and ideas can take them." He also said, "Transcendental style seeks to maximize the mystery of existence. It eschews all conventional interpretations of reality, realism, naturalism, psychologism, romanticism, expressionism, impressionism, and finally, rationalism." And all of those isms at the end are all a part of these interpretations of reality that he's talking about. So that was just a fun thing. I'm not going to go into like all of what that means, but he's kind of tying it into this unknowable, right? He's kind of tying it into taking out conventional methods to essentially transcend your experience. And so the religious influence on Schrader is pretty apparent. But speaking of religion, we're going to take a quick break and I'm going to come back and tell you a bit about the religious influence on Schrader's work. Earlier, I brought up that Schrader loves those truths that he can bring light to, those dark truths. One of those truths is Schrader wrestling with religion and spirituality. So Paul Schrader was able to go from Calvinist household, where movies were forbidden, to becoming a prominent and influential voice of modern American cinema. And this is a testament to his intellectual curiosity and determination to explore the deeper, often darker, aspects of the human experience. So his early exposure to religious texts and later rebellion against, you know, the confines of his upbringing provided him with the unique perspective that has come to define his work in the film industry. So Paul Schrader's relationship with religion and spirituality is deeply embedded in both his personal life and his career as a filmmaker and screenwriter. So, raised in that strict Calvinist family, as I brought up earlier, Schrader's upbringing was marked by rigorous spiritual discipline, which has, you know, had a lasting impact on his worldview and artistic expression. So his early life was dominated by a sense of spiritual rigor and later manifesting in his films as, you know, recurring explorations of moral existential themes. So Schrader's religious background is particularly evident in his development of the concept of transcendental style, as I previously described just a moment ago, a term he coined to describe a form of filmmaking that aims to evoke a sense of spiritual transcendence through the use of austere minimalist techniques. So this style is characterized by a deliberate withholding of those cinematic devices, like I brought up. But he withholds those cinematic devices so he can create a contemplative space where viewers are encouraged to engage with the film on a deeper level, a more spiritual level, one might say. And so Schrader's interest in this style reflects his ongoing engagement with spiritual and religious themes, even as his personal beliefs have evolved over time. And so throughout his career, Schrader has consistently returned to the themes of guilt and redemption and the search for meaning, all of which are deeply connected to his religious upbringing. And his films often feature characters grappling with moral dilemmas or alienation and or the burden of their past actions. And it really reflects Schrader's existential concerns. And so his work on films like Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, or The Last Temptation of Christ demonstrates a preoccupation with salvation, the nature of sin, you know, the possibility of redemption, things of that nature. So despite moving away from the strict religious belief system that he had as a youth, Schrader continues to explore the spiritual dimension of human experience in his work. And his films are often described as spiritual journeys, where the characters' external conflicts mirror their internal struggles with faith or morality and, you know, the meaning of existence. And in this sense, Schrader's relationship with religion and is complex and multifaceted. You know, he's serving as both a source of inspiration and a lens through which he examines the human condition. Why am I going on this religious tangent? Okay, you may be asking yourself. Well, I hope I haven't lost you, dear listeners. I simply want to help explain the thought process and complex thinking, I guess that was redundant, but in the context, really, for Schrader's style, in the hopes that this will highlight some of his choices when we get to his films. And so Schrader also expressed his discomfort with the idea of a sectarian God, one who favors one group or country, you know, over another. So like the concept of God is American, you know, because, you know, he's on our side, or however you want to look at it. You know, Schrader recounted how as a child he was taught to believe in God who was on our, in quotes, side, you know, punishing those who were not, our enemies, the other, right? And so this notion never sat well with Schrader, and he still struggles with it today. And Schrader questioned why God would need to choose sides and mentioned other theological concepts he found difficult to accept, such as the idea that people in remote parts of the world who died, you know, before missionaries reach them are just doomed to hell, or the concept of infant damnation. Schrader really struggled with a lot of these concepts. Again, why am I bringing this up? All of this informs his cinematic style. We'll talk about that some more here in a moment. So despite these reservations, Schrader actually acknowledged that religion at its best serves as a vessel for spirituality. However, at its worst, it can be a vessel for greed and selfishness and intolerance. And we see this depicted in his movies often. And so similarly, art can also serve as a vessel for spirituality, Schrader would say. And he cites the Dutch theologian Gerrit Cornelius Berkauer, who once said that religion and art run parallel to each other. And so for Schrader, this parallel underscores the potential of both religion and art to explore and express the spiritual dimension of human experience. So to say anyone in America is void of religious influence is just flat out incorrect. Our culture is so steeped in religious influence that even if we are unaware, it is present. Okay. When someone says, oh my God, or Jesus Christ, you know, although those have become kind of cultural phrases that we just use willy-nilly, it is still steeped in our Christian heritage as a country. And I'm not trying to get political here. I'm not trying to say we're a Christian nation. And that's not what I'm saying, but Christianity is steeped in our history. And so Schrader is able to discuss this in a way that can reach anyone willing to watch his films. And to clarify, if you've not seen a Schrader film, these are by no means Christian films, okay? Like quote-unquote Christian movies, right? God, no. I can just hear Matt Soucy saying like, oh my God, no. You know, but Schrader has not abandoned his religious past as much as he, you know, uses it to explore various aspects of life and existence, and in many cases, the darker sides of it. And so just, you know, if you want to see the darker sides of it here, just watch Taxi Driver, Hardcore, First Reformed, and you'll get a big dose, okay? So let's jump over to Schrader as a screenwriter, though. We'll get away from the religion thing here in a second, but I'm gonna loop back, so be ready. All right, so Schrader as a screenwriter, I absolutely love listening to Schrader talk about screenwriting because this is largely what I know him best for, even though recently I've, you know, become a big fan of his directorial work. But Schrader has discussed his philosophy an approach on screenwriting a lot, okay? So Schrader emphasizes that screenwriting is a personal and intuitive process that cannot be effectively taught through standardized methods or textbooks, such as those by Robert McKee, which Schrader also believes can do more harm than good. And so he explains that his method, which has remained consistent throughout his 50-year career, is based on his own experiences and is particularly suited for first-time writers or those working on narrative linear stories. But Schrader's approach to teaching screenwriting involves focusing on the functionality of storytelling, encouraging students to explore their own experiences and personal problems as, you know, the raw material for their scripts. So he advocates for the use of metaphors as a way to express personal issues without directly addressing them, allowing writers to create more powerful and resonant stories. And so Schrader also discusses the importance of plot, which he views as the result of driving a personal problem through a metaphor leading to a series of events that form a narrative. And so he gives a lot of great screenwriting tips and also that also match his own. But Schrader believes that screenwriting is part of the oral tradition, comparing it to storytelling, where the key is to engage the audience. He encourages writers to test their stories by telling them aloud and observing the reactions of their listeners, refining their narratives based on this feedback. And Schrader stresses the importance of knowing the ending of the script before beginning to write, as it provides a clear destination that can provide direction for the story. So consider these things when thinking about Schrader's approach in film. Tangent time, everybody. All right, so hear me out real quick, because this is actually something I'm going to come back to many times, I guarantee, as we talk about more and more films moving forward. And I want to talk about a little thing, and everybody who knows me is going to laugh when I say this, but I want to talk about BAVs, okay? And BAVs are beliefs, attitudes, and values, and these beliefs, attitudes, and values dictate how we as human beings think, feel, and behave. And all of that, how we think, feel, and behave, is all based on the lens in which we see the world. And what creates that lens? You know, it is our demographic makeup, essentially. It is our lived experiences. So for Schrader, it is the Calvinist church. It is his exploration and rebellion from that strict upbringing. It is his interest in that transcendental style, and quite frankly, an irreverence and aversion to the traditional narrative structures and devices, cinematic devices that he sees often. All of these things are not only based on his lived experiences, but also his religious affiliations. Like I said, his economic status, his geographical location, his race, his gender identity, his age, etc., etc. All of these things create that lens. And then we see in that lens, we see the world. We see everything. What we read, why we like a book or why we like a movie, all of these things are brought to us based on our BAVs. So why am I bringing this up? Well, the lens in which we see the world also affects what we create in the world. So when Schrader talks a lot about how people like Robert McKee and stuff, which I think have a place in the world, Robert McKee's job is to basically teach you how to write a spec script so you can get into industry. But what Schrader's arguing is art here. He's trying to argue that that is more harmful for creating art than his style. And Schrader would also tell you that he doesn't believe that one can really teach screenwriting, but rather you have to live it. You have to practice it. You have to pull from your experiences and create something that is your own. And even Paul Schrader, in some videos I've seen, has said, please steal from me. Like, take my things. Like, anything you learn from me, take it. Because his belief basically is learn everything you can about screenwriting and allow that to filter through the lived experiences you've had, those beliefs, attitudes, and values, and create something authentic. Okay, so whenever Schrader talks about screenwriting, he is essentially, in many ways, calling out to people's beliefs, attitudes, and values, and trying to use those to create something special, even if it doesn't end up in the same destination that Schrader's would. He pushes people to follow their own path. And so this is something I really love about Paul Schrader. And further, beliefs, attitudes, and values are something that are going to completely dictate how we talk about movies as well. Because if I love something, but Joe Scheer, for example, a friend of the show, hates something, it's probably because of this exact thing. So run with that. All right, let's talk about Paul Schrader's impact on cinema. And I will say it is profound and multifaceted. It spans over 5 decades of work as both a screenwriter and as a director, and his contributions to the industry are marked by a deep exploration of moral and existential themes, often rooted in his strict Calvinist upbringing. As I've said many times, Schrader's films, whether he is, you know, at the helm directing or just simply writing, are known for their intense psychological depth, their examination of the human condition, and their willingness to confront difficult and often uncomfortable truths. So why do I keep bringing up these uncomfortable truths and this darkness? Of course, it's a part of Schrader's style, but why is that so important? Well, for the sake of context, let me briefly address the climate within the film industry that Schrader came into. But I also want to talk a little bit about what happened before. And prior to 1966 to 68, technically it ended in 68, but in 66 is all but dead. It was called the Hays Code. This was also known as the Production Code, which I will do an entire episode on in the future. But it was a set of industry moral guidelines that governed the production of most motion pictures released by major studios in the United States from 1934 to, like I said, I like to say 1966. I think that's a nice number. We'll talk about why I use that number, that year, whenever I do an episode on it. But it was established to ensure that films adhered to certain moral standards, particularly in response to growing concerns about the influence of cinema on society. So even back in the early 1930s, because a form of the Hays Code started in 1930, but it completely did not really work until they really hit it home in 1934. And so What the Hays Code was it was censorship. And there were people all the way back in the early 30s that were saying, ah, they're corrupting our children. This art is going to be bad news. And so they created this thing to try to change that. And instead of allowing a rating system like we have today, which allows people to make their own choices, this would literally not allow filmmakers to do certain things. So, for example, the Hays Code was enforced by the Motion Picture Producers and Distributors of America, the MPPDA. Later known as the Motion Picture Association of America, the MPAA, which is also changed again since, which is simply now the Motion Picture Association, which is MPA. So when you go to the theater and you see a trailer and in the bottom right of the screen it says MPA, you know what that is now. So, you know, dropping letters left and right, folks. The bill is named after William H. Hays, the president of the MPPDA. This is the old version. That aimed to avoid what was considered morally unacceptable content in films. And this included anything that might lower the moral standards of viewers or glorify criminal behavior or undermine the sanctity of marriage and family. The code was divided into two main parts, the don'ts and the be carefuls, and I'll read a handful of these, but I'll address them again in more depth, but just to give you an idea, all right? So pointed profanity, specifically using any words including God, Lord, Christ, Jesus. These are the don'ts, by the way. Hell, damn, even things like God. G-A-W-D is an actual don't, which is really funny to me. But any similar terms like that. Illegal traffic in drugs, so showing or glamorizing illegal drug use. White slavery was actually a thing. Sex hygiene or venereal disease, any discussions or depictions of these topics were a no-no. Children's sex organs, ridicule of the clergy, so any attacks on religion or religious figures, etc. So these were don'ts, and there are several of them, and I'll go into them in more depth in the future because I find it fascinating. But then the be carefuls were a little different, like the use of the American flag. So, you know, they wanted to ensure proper respect for the American flag. You couldn't do anything too bad. Or the use of firearms. So they wanted to carefully depict to avoid promoting gun violence. So oftentimes back then you had to fire a gun on one frame and then they'd edit over to another person who would act like they got shot at that moment. It was in two completely different scenes. Part of what made Sergio Leone so special when his movies came over, but I digress. We'll talk about that in a later episode. So techniques of committing murder, which Hitchcock did all the time. I mean, just watch Rope, Strangers on a Train, Rear Window, but whatever. rape and attempted rape. I mean, first night scenes, depictions of wedding nights and things. Men and women had to sleep in different beds. I mean, there were all these different things. One of my favorites actually is excessive or lustful kissing. I love that phrasing. And it was limited to like brief, non-suggestive depictions, usually no longer than 3 seconds. I love how Hitchcock bypassed this. If I remember correctly, it's in... nope, I lost it. But Hitchcock bypassed this by having multiple kisses less than 3 seconds in a row. Oh, Notorious. Yes, Notorious is the movie. 1946, I think. Going off the dome here. But anyways, he had a great way of getting around it, and so did a lot of filmmakers. So when we talk about the production code era, that Hays Code era, I love talking about filmmakers who were kind of breaking the rules. We'll get there. I digress yet again. So why is all of this important? Well, the new Hollywood movement happened after that. I would argue that in 1966, when Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf came out, that all but was the final nail in the Hays Code coffin. Furthermore, Jack Valenti became the kind of head of the MPAA. And so that whole thing changed. And by 1968, they literally changed it over to the rating system. So I don't really consider 1966 to 68 really kind of counting in that. That's why I ended at 1966. But the movement began in around 1966-ish and took off with the kind of official demise of the Hays Code, like I said. And why did it meet its demise? Well, by the late 1950s and 1960s, societal attitudes were changing. Okay, this is no surprise to us. And the rigid enforcement of the Hays Code became increasingly difficult. Films like Psycho from 1960 or Bonnie and Clyde from 1967, again, after the years that I would claim, but those began really pushing the boundaries of what was accessible, not acceptable, to mention movies like The Apartment, which I've talked about many times on the show in the past, but this exposed the limitations of the Hays Code. And in 1968, the now MPAA, led by Jack Valenti, introduced a new film rating system. So unlike the Hays Code, which was, let's not forget, direct censorship, the rating system did not censor content, but instead categorized films based on their suitability for different audiences. So the new system allowed filmmakers greater creative freedom to explore mature and controversial themes, as films were no longer judged by a single standard of morality, but were instead rated according to their content and the appropriate audience. Now, with the loosening of restrictions under the rating system, a new generation of filmmakers emerged, eager to explore more complex, realistic, and socially relevant themes. And this period is known as the New Hollywood Movement, which saw directors gaining more control over their products and often serving as the primary creative forces behind their films. And it is during this time Schrader came into the industry and brought his unique style to the masses. So as a screenwriter, Schrader has penned some of the most iconic and influential films in American cinema. His collaborations with director Martin Scorsese, particularly on Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, and The Last Temptation of Christ, have become cornerstones of modern filmmaking. Taxi Driver, with its haunting portrayal of alienation and urban decay, introduced audiences to one of the most unforgettable antiheroes in cinema, Travis Bickle, played by Robert De Niro, of course. And Schrader's script delves into the psyche of a man on the edge, grappling with loneliness and an intense desire for meaning in a world that seems to have abandoned him. And I personally would call it a character study of one dealing with PTSD and having difficulty reassimilating into society after Vietnam, if he ever was assimilated in the first place. And this film is not only solidified, it didn't only solidify Schrader's reputation as a masterful screenwriter, but also influenced countless filmmakers who sought to explore several themes of existential despair and societal collapse. So similarly, Raging Bull, which Schrader co-wrote with Mardik Martin, is a powerful exploration of self-destruction and redemption, going back to some of those themes that I've brought up before, like redemption, chronicling the rise and fall of boxer Jake LaMotta. And the film's raw intensity and unflinching portrayal of its protagonist's inner demons are hallmarks of Schrader's writing. The Last Temptation of Christ, another collaboration with Scorsese, stirred controversy with its humanistic portrayal of Jesus, reflecting Schrader's lifelong fascination with the intersection of spirituality and human frailty. So these screenwriting achievements have left an indelible mark on cinema, influencing a generation of filmmakers and writers who have followed in Schrader's footsteps. And as a director, Schrader has built a body of work that is challenging and thought-provoking, just as much as his screenwriting. His directorial debut, Blue Collar, from 1978, showcased his ability to tell stories that are both socially relevant and deeply personal. The film, which examines the struggles of working-class Americans, was a critical success established Schrader as a filmmaker with a distinct voice. And then you have American Gigolo from 1980, which perhaps one of his most commercially successful films, delved into themes of identity and morality and the superficiality of modern life. Richard Gere's portrayal of the male escort searching for meaning in a world of materialism and emblematic of Schrader's ongoing exploration of characters who are lost and seeking redemption. However, it is Schrader's 1997 film Affliction that stands out as one of the most significant directorial efforts. The film, which earned James Coburn an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor, it is a harrowing exploration of family trauma, guilt, and the cynical nature of abuse. And Schrader's direction is taught with and uncompromising. It's capturing the bleakness of its characters' lives with a stark realism that is both unsettling and poignant. And then, of course, you have what would later become his like modern masterpiece, First Reformed in 2017, another directorial triumph, which revisits Schrader's interest in spirituality and moral conflict. The film, which follows a tormented pastor grappling with his face and environmental destruction and existential dread. And this was hailed as a return to form for Schrader and earned widespread critical acclaim. Now, the distinction between Schrader's work as a director and as a screenwriter lies in the different levels of control and creative expression each role affords. So as a screenwriter, Schrader has collaborated with some of the greatest directors of his time, bringing his unique voice to their visions. And his scripts have provided the foundation for films that have become cultural touchstones, influencing not only the directors who brought them to life, but also the broader cinematic landscape. And in contrast, as a director, Schrader has been able to more fully realize his personal vision, crafting films that reflect his deep-seated preoccupations with morality and spirituality and human suffering. And so in both capacities, Schrader's impact on cinema is undeniable. He has pushed the boundaries of storytelling, challenging audiences to confront difficult questions about themselves and the world around them. And his films, whether written or directed, are imbued with a sense of urgency and importance, making them essential viewing for anyone interested in the power of cinema to explore the human condition. And mind you, maybe not all of them are must-sees, but he has a lot of must-sees, folks. Okay, so we'll get there. Schrader's legacy is one of uncompromising artistic integrity. And that is what a lot of his work, both in film and outside of film, like the book Transcendental Style, it's really all about the uncompromising artistic integrity of his work. And he has... his contributions to the art of filmmaking will continue to resonate with generations to come, I have no doubt. So now that I've laid the foundational groundwork for Paul Schrader, I'll be back in just a moment to talk a little bit about what we're going to do for next week. I don't know. All that to say, I'll be right back. Hang tight. Thank you all so much for taking this journey, this deep dive into Paul Schrader. I hope this was interesting. I don't know. I'm really interested in this crap. Okay. I love learning the in-depth stuff about different filmmakers and different processes. I just absolutely adore it. And just being able to go through, his early life and understanding his background and then the transcendental style and then talking about his philosophy on screenwriting and moving into, talking about his religious upbringing and how that ties into his work and BAVs and all the things. I just really appreciate you going on that journey with me. And next week, we're going to talk about some of his movies and we're going to start drawing some of this stuff in. And using this kind of framework that we've established in this episode, and we're going to build on it like scaffolding, right? And we're going to start looking at some of his other movies and whatnot. My goal is just to create maybe a bit more of a film history thing. This is my interest. This is really my true background. This is like the thing I love to do. So I hope that you've enjoyed it. New films coming out next week? Fucking nothing, bro. There are movies, but kind of crazy. I mean, this week, we have Blink Twice, The Crow. What was that one movie? Strange Darling came out, which I saw. Interesting movie. Alien Romulus is still out, which was like surprisingly good, actually, in terms of the production. I was like really impressed that it felt like there was a real vision there, even though it really just comes down to being kind of a pretty derivative horror work, but it was like good though. Like, I encourage you to check it out. It's pretty cool. But this week, like, fucking nothing's coming out, dude. Except for there's a Shaun of the Dead re-release. I think the Batman's being re-released. I'm looking at a list right now and I'm just like, bro, what is even happening right now? So, take a look if you want. The next week we have some more stuff coming out, but you'll have to tune in to the to our next episode, and I'll talk a little bit about what's coming out next. All that said, just don't forget to get on our social media. Definitely send me some messages. Shoot me an email, mediumcoolpod@gmail.com. Hit us up, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, or X. I'm going to keep calling it Twitter, guys. I think X is fucking stupid. I think I've said this multiple times. I'm going to say this every time, probably. But tweet at us in spite. Just in spite, I'm going to call it Twitter. Anyways, I digress. Hey, everybody, I've held you long enough. Thank you so much. Let me know what you think. Otherwise, good night, good luck, and take it easy.